Welcome to 90.5 WESA, Life of Learning Community Forum. I'm Larkin Page Jacobs. When a state budget is finally passed, schools will receive about $6 billion from the Commonwealth. On average, that'll make up about 36% of the school district's revenue. According to federal data, Pennsylvania's home to the widest gap in funding between the poorest and wealthiest communities. While all of Pennsylvania's 500 school districts receive state and federal funding, many of them are also heavily dependent on local revenues, including property taxes. That doesn't always mean poorer districts receive less money from the Commonwealth, but it does mean that they're more dependent on the state for much of their funding. Pennsylvania is one of the few states that doesn't have a funding formula that accounts for the poverty rate of a district. During this forum, we'll explore the meaning of equitable funding for public education. This is a complicated topic. You're going to hear a lot of numbers, but it's about more than just dollars when it comes to a child's education. Here to help explain the topic are State Senator Jay Costa, a member of the Basic Education Funding Commission, Ron Cowell, president of the Education Policy and Leadership Center, Linda Kraushor, executive director of the Consortium for Public Education, Linda Lane, superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools, and Eric Montardi, senior policy analyst for the Allegheny Institute for Public Policy. A reminder to the audience, we'll be taking your questions throughout the evening, but first to the panel. I'm going to start by asking how each of you would define equitable funding for public education. Start with you, Jay Costa.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for the chance to be here to talk about this important issue and very timely issue, I think I might add, as we go forward in our budget conversations. I mean, to me, equitable funding means that we take in various factors and considerations to finding the best way possible to make certain that every child gets a good education. And the investments are made along those lines to be able to be certain that that is, in fact, the case. So you look at various factors and variables to come with an appropriate formula to try to achieve that.
The conversation has really moved beyond the word equitable, and it's really about adequacy now. Back in the 70s and even the 80s, there was a lot of discussion among policymakers and the courts and others about equalness. But once we began to have academic standards, expectations of all students, defined by state law in our 50 states, there became a new measure of the appropriateness of a statewide school funding system. And so now the real test is adequate funding for every student, regardless of where the dollars come from. We need to keep in mind, though, that the purpose of a state-level funding system and the purpose of state funding is to level the playing field because, as you suggested in your introduction, we've got 500 districts in this state with very different circumstances, very different means to pay their own way. So the real question is, do we provide adequate funding to give every student a reasonable opportunity to accomplish these academic expectations or these academic proficiencies for which we now hold them accountable? That's the real challenge.
And that was Ron Cowell. Linda Kraushor.
And as we talk about equity and adequacy, we also look at the idea of an opportunity to learn for every child. And an opportunity to learn means that if we want all children to achieve, then we need to be thinking about what that takes for each child. And it is not across the board a similar concept. Trying to understand that one child may need a paper and a pencil and a book, and another may need so much more to give them the chance to achieve is something that is very difficult for many people to consider. But if we want an economy that truly is growing the number of prepared workers, ready workers, etc., not only do we have to find hope and confidence for every child to believe that they are part of the future, but we have to create the chance for them to have success in their learning, and we have to think about how that differs across the children of Pennsylvania.
Dr. Lee?
Two things come to mind when I think about this particular topic, especially as we began talking about it over the course of the last year or so. One, I was very unused to seeing such a wide variation in spend per child across a state. Coming from a state with a foundation aid formula, it was pretty tight. I mean, most of us were spending about the same, and the state really made up the gap for poorer communities. So that, to me, was, as I said, first time I'd seen that was when I came to Pennsylvania, which I found quite unusual. Another piece that I was surprised at is I was used to an algorithm that told me about how much money we were going to get based on allowable growth. And so it wasn't predictable because, I mean, it was a bad corn crop. You didn't get much money. That's how it worked. But it was that everybody could figure out how much everybody else would get. And so we all knew what numbers went into it. And that is something that I was unused to not having, because this appeared to be more of a black box. I didn't know what went on in there. A number came out, but I didn't know how it got there. And the last thing I think we're very concerned about is the difference between equity and equality. Equality, you know, equal is everybody gets treated the same. And I think we all know, and our best example, well, two great examples are children with special needs, children that are English language learners. And we all know, and we all accept the fact, it costs more to educate them well. They just need more support and typically more social services than some of our other children. So thinking about that, because for us, that issue of equity will be extremely important, what that looks like. And I'm always wanting to know who's going to define it, because that's really very important to us.
And Eric?
I would say that after listening and reviewing what the Basic Education Funding Commission did for a year, and they listened to about 100 different testifiers, including some of the folks that were up here this evening, experts from around the country, I guess equitable funding would be that the way Pennsylvania does it, which is a combination of state and local finances, means that the places that need more money from the state get more money from the state. But that doesn't necessarily mean, when you put all the sources together, that the state money means that those districts spend more or have more revenue per pupil than the places that just can raise a lot of money locally. And I think until we get to the crux of that issue, even driving out new money through this formula, we may see results that may not look equitable as compared to what we've been doing for the last few decades.
Okay, so speaking of what we've been doing for the last few decades, I wanted to ask, why is a mandated funding formula important? And I know that, Ron, you know a little bit of the history, and so I was hoping you could speak to that and then maybe open it up. Why is this mandated for? You guys are all education experts, but for the common person, why so important?
Well, it's important that you have a rational way of distributing billions of dollars of state money and that rational way be attached to a purpose. It goes back to my remark earlier that the ultimate purpose of state funding is to level the playing field. So that there is equity, but equity of opportunity for all kids, regardless of the zip code where you live or the relative wealth of your district. This equity question is more about opportunity for kids rather than the dollars themselves. The dollars need to be adequate or sufficient to provide equal opportunity for all kids, regardless of where they live. We had a rational formula in Pennsylvania in the 70s and 80s when the assumption was that the legislature or state government was going to fund about 50% of K-12 education. And we actually did that in 1974, shortly after Pennsylvania initiated an income tax. State was pretty flush with money, and our state share got up to about 54% in 1974. Now it's down around 35, 36%, depending on what year. That difference is several billions of dollars of value. So we had that formula, but we began to dishonor it. And this goes back to even my days in the legislature. When the legislature found it inconvenient to provide sufficient dollars to support a formula, that formula, again, being intended to assure that the state would pay about 50% of the total cost. If you manipulate a formula and you just change a dollar figure a little bit to serve the needs of the legislature, you save the state money, but you begin to shift more and more of the burden to local government. And the more that you make the system dependent on local wealth, the more you make it likely that there'll be this unevenness of opportunity for kids. Because in some communities, no matter how much you try to tax, there's just not a tax base there. So this formula is important now because, it was abandoned about 20 years ago. just became inconvenient for the legislature to appropriately fund it. And then finally, we quit pretending that we were supporting a formula and just began a more arbitrary distribution of dollars based on an arbitrary appropriation that had nothing to do with the real needs of kids. We lived like that for a couple of decades. We got to the point when the legislature demanded mandated a costing out study. At that point, only Pennsylvania and Rhode Island were operating without a formula that would be based on the needs of kids and that would be predictable, as the superintendent suggested. A superintendent or a board of directors would have some idea what they were going to get. So we are getting close to beginning to use a formula again for the distribution at least of the new state money, and the senator can probably best speak to that issue and the formula and the likelihood of it being applied. But the formula is important, one, because it ought to be based on the needs of kids. Secondly, it ought to speak to predictability. That is, the superintendents and others in the field will know what they're supposed to get from the state. And thirdly, it ought to create an obligation for state government so that state government knows what it ought to be appropriating year after year. And then the key is, will the legislature honor that, or will the legislature and the governor honor that obligation? But the formula is at the root of all of that. And so that's why it's important that we embrace one and then stick to it.
And Jay Costa, would you call the distribution of funds arbitrary right now?
I think they have been, as Representative Kyle talked about. But I think as we go forward, the question today and going forward this week will be determining how we drive out these new dollars that we're discussing in Harrisburg, whether they be for this year, which is the 15-16 year, or 16-17. That answer hasn't been reached yet in terms of how we're going to deal with this year's money. Next year, I think you'll see us driving out resources under a new formula, the new basic education formula. But this year, you may see some type of a hybrid or something along those lines, or some type of a combining of various ideas with respect to how we drive it out this year. So I guess to continue some of the things that have gone on for a number of years. But definitely going forward, I think in 16-17, you'll see a new formula in place.
You mentioned that the budget is like a black box for you. Well, what does that look like in day-to-day operations? What does that mean for you? This is Linda Lane.
And, of course, our district is on a different budget cycle than I think everybody else in the state, except for maybe one, because we're on a calendar year cycle, not a fiscal year. And even though that seems strange at first, it actually has helped us with this kind of unpredictability of where we're going to be from year to year on money, because we have to build a budget. And, in fact, we're going to be presenting the 2016 budget to the board. They saw the preliminary budget. They'll vote on a budget next month. Ordinarily, if you don't know and you start building a budget, because we start in the spring, and we don't have any idea as to where we're going to be in terms of the state revenue, our other revenue is a little more predictable. Earned income tax is more predictable. Property tax is more predictable. But that piece of it has been, we just have to wait. And so, as I said, you're developing a budget that's based on some assumptions. And, you know, you can be wrong.
Okay. Linda Krauscher, you called it fiction?
Yeah, you weren't supposed to hear that. But I do think sometimes that's exactly what is happening. And it's a shame to have such good intentions and watch them be cast aside because the reality is not what one expects.
Okay. Anything you wanted to add, Eric?
I would just, make the points that there are other things in the state that's driven out by formula, and there's complaints about those, too, that they're not fair. So, it does make rational sense to say, as opposed to just giving the district what they got the year before and supplementing it with some other money, saying, well, we're going to give the money through a formula. If you look at the preliminary results right now, just in Allegheny County, the districts that are at the top getting the most money per pupil from the state from the previous year, 14-15, they're pretty much at the top with the formula. It's going to take a long time for this formula to kick in because there's a three-year rolling average on enrollment. There's issues related to the density or the sparsity of the district. There's relative factors to the state on median household income. If you think of the districts here and say, well, which ones do I think get the most money from the state based on the wealth of the community or the lack of wealth, and which districts do I think get the least amount of money from the state based on the wealth of the community? It doesn't move much next year based on just taking the formula and saying, let's put $100 million through it. It's going to take a long time because, again, as the senator mentioned, the proposal that's on the table now is, well, you're still going to get what you got in 14-15. We're just going to take new money and put it out through the formula. And again, yeah, it is rational and predictable to put the state money through a formula. What's the formula for the local money? It's based on what the community can raise, I guess. So again, it kind of gets to this point of, well, yeah, there is this gap between districts, but how much of that is on the part of the state as opposed to what's being raised locally?
Okay. We're going to get to the recommendations from the panel in a second, but I wanted to ask you, Jay Costa, when you first met with the commission, what was your plan? Before you even had the recommendations, what was the goal?
Well, a couple things. I ended up joining the commission about halfway through the process because my colleague who I had appointed, Senator Matt Smith, had resigned from office, and it was an opportunity. I needed to appoint someone else, and I thought it'd be a great opportunity for me to sort of dive in and figure out this process and learn more about it. You know, at that point, there had been a number of hearings and meetings and conversations along those lines. But my goal was to make certain that we came out of it with a product that was going to be able to provide for an appropriate funding plan and recommendation that would be reasonable and acceptable to the General Assembly, and that was one of our challenges. If I had written the plan, I think it looked a lot different than maybe Chairman Brown would have written. But we had to have an acknowledgement and understanding that we had to do something that was going to be accepted by the members of the General Assembly that have various ideas about what the appropriate formula needs to be. So my goal was to try to get in and work to develop something that could be accepted and adopted in an unanimous way, as we did, to help move through this process.
Okay. And Ron Cal, I know you also gave testimony during some of the hearings, but what did you have to say?
Yeah, up in Clarion, I was invited to give testimony. But 2 points I wanted to make. This idea of the hold harmless.
Can you say that again?
The idea of hold harmless, that is the principle that a school district will get at least what it got the year before and nothing less. On the one hand, that's absurd. All of your kids could disappear, and with that principle applied, you would still get the same amount of money from the state that you got the year before. And in some ways, the accumulation of applying that principle for decades leads to some pretty strange situations in the view of some, because districts have had a dramatic decrease in population, student enrollment, but they're still getting what they got from the state in years past. But on the other hand, politically speaking first, no legislator wants to go back home and announce to their constituents, I got you less money than you got last year. I was in that business for 24 years, and unfortunately, superintendents and board members and my constituents never asked what I did to serve a bigger purpose. They asked, did you get us more money? So there's a political reality to this hold harmless principle. But the other reality also that is makes a lot more sense beyond the politics is that the state has been so bad at appropriately funding all school districts, but particularly the poorest, that probably all districts could reasonably make the case that they're not getting a fair share from the state to begin with. So the idea of giving them less, even though they lost some kids, it just is more salt in the wound, if you will. So the idea, the purpose, you asked Senator Costa about what he had in mind with the commission. The idea was to create a more reasonable way of distributing the new state money. Now, again, ideally, you might apply that principle to all the money, but there'd be winners and losers again. And the political reality is that's not going to happen. But if you can begin to distribute $300 or $400 million of new money this year and another $200, $300, $400 million next year, you, as Eric said, it takes a while to cure the issue, make it better, but you begin to make important strides forward. And I think that's what the legislature and Governor Wolf are trying to do now. They're doing that with the support of the biggest coalition we've ever seen, advocating for school funding reform now, the FAIR campaign, or the Campaign for Fair Education Funding. So we are on the cusp of making some important steps forward, not just because there's a new formula, because a formula doesn't mean anything if there's not a lot of new money. But if the legislature steps up to the plate, adds a lot of new money this year, and continues to add it in subsequent years, we'll see important steps forward.
And you also gave testimony during the hearings?
Yes, Linda twice.
Yes. What were you trying to convey?
And one of the things I spoke about was hold harmless as well, because Pittsburgh Public Schools has been protected because of enrollment laws through hold harmless. For us, it's extremely important, and I told our legislators that. The district, as everybody who's local knows, has done a lot to deal with our budget issues and reduce our spending. And, you know, we've laid off staff, we've closed schools, it's been very difficult. However, hold harmless has kept it from being even worse. And for us, hold harmless is significant. We're talking millions of dollars here. And for us to have to absorb that at one time would be—it can't work. We just can't do it. So, it's very important to us that hold harmless stay in place.
Okay. Did you want to add anything? Let's all look. So I'm going to run through the commission's recommendations, and they include accounting for the number of students in a district, percent of students living below the poverty line, the number of English language learners, foster care and homeless student information, charter school enrollment, adjustment for student counts in small rural districts, and household median income and the district's ability to generate tax revenue. And I would ask all of you, that's a lot of stipulations, did the commission get the formula right?
I would say yes.
Jay Costa says yes.
I voted for it twice, yes.
I think that it's a very important step forward. It's far better than we've had before. Just the idea of counting the kids is a remarkable difference from where we have been the last several years. One of the things to be accomplished with the idea of the formula and using it is to get away from the political process that we've had for the last several years. I mean, after those awful cuts that occurred in 2011, where the poorest districts in the state and here in Allegheny County took the biggest cuts and the richest districts took very modest cuts, when the legislature stepped in to begin to restore some of the money, and they have restored only about a third of nearly $1 billion that was cut, the first year when a lot of it was restored, it was done by a political deal. If you were a legislator who was a leader or your leader needed your vote for something, you were one of those districts that got some extra help, some restoration, and the rest of the districts, most of the 500, were largely ignored. The legislature, and I'm not being critical, I'm just stating facts, everybody swore they were going to get away from WHAMs, walking around money. Well, that deal on some districts getting some money and most not looked a whole lot like WHAMs, although nobody used that word. So one of the big things happening with the adoption of a formula and really using it is get away from a WHAM-like approach to funding schools. That's a remarkable reform if we can do it.
Ron's referring to, I believe, the distress school list that we put together. Is that what you're referring to with some of the distribution?
Well, there were 11 there were or 12 categories, and it had all kinds of names.
Yes. Well, they were. That was one of the big ones. It was about $70 million that was driven out, for example, to distressed communities, of which they were not all truly distressed communities. They were the formula for distressed was manufactured to achieve some of the ends that Ron talked about. There's no question.
And most children in this Commonwealth go to school for 13 years, kindergarten through 12th grade. They each get one chance to succeed in each year. and with conditions like that. I wonder if that has anything to do with some of the increase in crime and the difficulty and truly the growing number of kids in poverty. I think that we really have far-reaching impacts toward the decisions we make, even in just in education. It is not only affecting what happens in a classroom. It's what happens in a community.
And my opinion on the things that are would be given technically, I guess, a weighting in the formula, I think it makes sense. I mean, as I said, we're really already doing it in special education. We do get some additional money to support English language learners, and that makes total sense, I think, to pretty much everybody. One of the things that I think for an urban district like ours and several others in the state that kind of has gotten left out of this discussion is achievement disparities based on race. And that's important to consider as well. We in our district are, you know, fighting that battle to make sure that our children of color are achieving similarly as our other children in the district, and that's been a struggle. When I testified, one of the things I asked that the legislators consider was how can we provide better mental health, those type of services for children who live some kind of traumatizing existence sometime. And when I talked to our principals last year, I meet with each one of them individually, that was a recurring theme I heard from them. We need more mental health services. And that's something that I think often doesn't get considered in a state where most of the districts are probably a little different than ours in many ways. But as I said, for us, this is really important. And that, as far as I know, is not a part of what's going to be considered.
I would say that the commission, I mean, from everybody that it heard from over the years' time or so that it had people in to testify, I mean, I don't think there was anything that was mentioned in a hearing that probably didn't make it into the formula. I would say the one thing that we probably are not thinking about in this part of the state that the commission did hear from other parts of the state about the hold harmless is there's districts that are growing, and they want more of this state money. I mean, we have one district probably in Allegheny County, South Fayette, that's grown by more than 150, what they call ADM, average daily membership, which is basically a proxy for headcount. So while, you know, Dr. Lane mentioned that, you know, yeah, hold harmless helps where the district is shrinking because then you have to absorb this change. Well, in this formula, there's this three-year rolling average of your enrollment along with the other weights. So, I mean, the commission did hear, you know, from a lot of people, superintendents and board members, and other, you know, folks from other parts of Pennsylvania where they have districts that are growing, and they say, you know, we have more students, but yet, you know, communities out west, you know, in the rural parts or in the urban parts are basically just getting the same amount that they got years before. And I would also just add, I mean, one of the things we haven't mentioned is if anybody wants to see, you know, the commission's work, read the people that read the testimony, that's all available on a website that's still live, including the final report that was issued in June.
You went through a list of elements of the formula, and most of those things have been around in the past. A lot of it looks like the formula that I referenced from 1980s, but there's one important element that is really important to many school districts, including here in Allegheny County, certainly the Pittsburgh district, and that's consideration of charter school students. That's a new element to the formula, it just reflects the reality that we have some school districts in the state, particularly urban districts, but not exclusively urban districts, that are faced with enormous additional costs to support students who, for whom they have an obligation, but who happen to be enrolled in charter schools. And so the school district has to write a check to those charter schools. So this is an important addition to the formula. But the other thing that just needs to be underscored, as good as the formula might be, as rational as it might be, I've called it a step forward. Without money, it's meaningless. And so that's why Senator Costa, I know, and others are fighting hard to make sure that we begin to address this question of adequacy, adequate funding, to really make this formula work effectively.
It's a Life of Learning community forum on 90.5 WESA. We're discussing equitable funding for public education in Pennsylvania with our panel, Eric Montardi from the Allegheny Institute, Linda Lane, superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools, Linda Kraushor of the Consortium for Public Education, State Senator Jay Costa, and an audience at the Community Broadcast Center. And with that, I want to turn it over to the audience for a moment and take any questions you might have. Gesundheit. For the panel?
There we go.
Yes, one in the back.
Hi, my name is Ken Harris, from Brownsville, Pennsylvania. And I had a question generally about the effect of taxpayer-funded cyber schools. It seems possibly to me that it would be difficult to maintain proper standards and making sure the students are getting the education they would get in a regular environment. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that, please?
Yeah, I'd love to respond to that.
Sure.
When I testified in Harrisburg, I talked about this. We have a number of charter schools that our board has chartered in the district, about nine, and supporting our charter schools is part of what we do. However, the idea that we are paying the same per student cost to children in a cyber charter as a regular charter, I don't understand. And why is that? Because the actual cost of educating a child in a cyber school, whether it's charter or otherwise, is substantially less than it is in a brick-and-mortar school. And so for the taxpayers to foot the bill for the difference and fund them all the same, that's the part I don't understand, and that's something I wish we could address in Pennsylvania.
I can tell you that the earlier in March, the governor's proposal included significant changes and reforms to how we fund our charter schools, particularly our cyber schools. In fact, what they did was they went around the state and looked at the IUs and how they've handled the charter school the cyber school programs, and came up with an average. I think it was like $5,900 per student, and that unfortunately has gotten lost in this whole conversation, this budget impasse that we've had. But looking at how we fund our charter schools and so many accountability measures and things along those lines, transparency and the like, we've not been able to focus on that as part of this budget. I will tell you that one of the single biggest issues that we hear from superintendents, including Dr. Lane and so many others, is how we fund charter schools. It is having a major, major impact, and we've got to get our arms around this issue sooner than later, because it is the single biggest cost driver I think the school districts are dealing with, and we just have our work to do. But unfortunately, it just got consumed. Or did not get consumed in the work that we're doing right now. It sort of got pushed to the back burner. But I do expect that this will be another conversation that will begin with the governor's next budget address, which will be in February, to continue to talk about some of the reforms that need to take place along those lines.
And Linda Crashore, did you want to speak to that at all?
I think that when we think about our charter schools and we think about our K-12 schools that we're used to, we think about a classroom of 25 students, that when five students are taken out of it, one still needs a teacher, one still needs a classroom, one still needs all of the resources that go with that student and that student deserves. But all of a sudden, a lot of money is leaving that classroom because a student is making another choice. And it takes away from opportunities to provide technology. It takes away from opportunities to provide many other things. Poor Ron, he's going to be upset with me.
I have another question.
But,
oh, sorry.
Yes, Ron wants to say something.
Oh, I have another question at the back of the room.
Hi, my name is Katie Fortner, and you touched on what I was going to ask, so I'm going to ask specifically, what are your thoughts? I started my teaching career in Illinois, and in Illinois, the how the charter versus district money goes is the state issues the money to the charter. So you mentioned, Senator Jade Costa, that the conversation just didn't get developed in this round. So I'm going to ask specifically to all of you if you could share your thoughts on the idea of money coming straight from the state to charters and not through districts.
Sure. Linda Lane?
Our concern about such a plan would be one of the things that happens now is when our charters send us who the children are that they're educating, you know, what the child's address and all those kind of things, we audit that bill. And typically we find children that aren't at that school. Sometimes they may have been at one point and they're not now. They may have come back to us. They may have gone someplace else. So if there were a process in place to ensure that there was going to be an auditing of who's being reported as a part of that charge for the charter education part of it, then that would be something I'd be concerned about. And I guess because I know Pennsylvania Department of Education is pretty stretched out right now in terms of small staff, and I would be concerned as to whether they would be able to do such a thing, because it's a lot of work for us, and so that would be our worry.
Ron, you've been waiting.
Yeah. First, I think it's really important when we have this discussion about charters that we distinguish between cyber charter schools and brick-and-mortar charter mm-hmm. schools. And I think even the cyber operators and the brick-and-mortar operators understand the distinction, even though there may still be a single association that represents them all. There are significant differences. So that's the first thing. Secondly, the legislature, in the late 90s, when passing this charter school law, one didn't anticipate this thing called cyber education, cyber charter schools. The internet was still a baby then. And they also made some really wrong assumptions about the funding issue. It was assumed that school districts would save money because students would go to charter schools. And so they set up a system that was kind of predicated on that assumption. But that's like with this audience that we have here this evening. If one of you got up and walked out, and you might be 5% of the audience, the light bill is not 5% less than it was. Or if somebody was getting paid for this, their salary wasn't going to be reduced by 5%. So the law and the funding mechanism was predicated on some really wrong thinking. And the legislature recognized that for a number of years when they began to reimburse school districts for up to 30% of their charter school payments. But then part of the nearly billion-dollar cut that occurred in 2011 was the elimination of what was then $223 million of state support going to school districts to help them be reimbursed for some of their charter school expenses. So, you know, we need to understand that background. The question that was asked, will we change the system dramatically and go to state money going directly to the charter schools, be they cyber or brick and mortar? Not likely to happen. And the superintendent identified some of the big problems with that. But we need to better fund all of public education, the charters being a part of it. Mm-hmm. School districts will have more capacity to pay charters when they are appropriately funded or assisted by the state. Now, on the issue of the cybers in particular, the gentleman asked about, I just want to go back to that for a moment. There was just a report this week, I'm just quoting. I don't know if it's fair or not, but its analysis of cybers around the country concluded that it was almost like the kids weren't there at all. It was that kind of an indictment of the academic program, the academic experience. So we need to go back and look at that report a little bit more carefully. But the reality is that in Pennsylvania, the several cyber charter schools that we have, the cybers, not the brick and mortar, unanimously have been failing from an academic standpoint. And when 13 applications have been submitted to the Pennsylvania Department of Education during the last couple years of the Corbett administration and the first year of the Wolf administration, they have all been denied because the folks in the Department of Education, even with their limited capacity, have recognized the insufficiency of these applications and the huge question marks about the track record of cyber charter schools here in Pennsylvania so far. Final comment I would make, though, because a lot of my friends in the advocacy community, including some legislators, sometimes get overexcited about indicting cybers. We got to be careful. We're going to see more and more cyber education mm-hmm. conducted by our intermediate units and our school districts. It's just going to be a part of the way we educate kids. So even while we challenge the idea of cyber charter schools in Pennsylvania, we need to be careful that we don't indict cyber education in its totality because it's part of the new way that we're educating a lot of kids, at least in part.
And Eric, did you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was going to just mention to the person that raised the question. I don't know. Do you still have a microphone back there? How many school districts does Illinois have? It's more than Pennsylvania. It's about 150 more, I believe. Just like Ohio, and somehow they've managed to figure out that the state can somehow just say, okay, we're going to send the money directly to the student, The student takes it either to the school district where they go, right, or they go to a charter school. I don't know if that's the way the funding formula works, but somehow they've figured that out. So imagine a system like that in Pennsylvania where we've kind of done away with the, you know, the locals don't have a role in, we're raising this much money for education. It's the state funds it, whether it comes to, you have to come through a tax shift, you know, sales, income tax, whatever. The state funds 100% of the education, and then the state decides what's equitable, what's fair. Is it we give the same amount per pupil in no matter where you live, if it's based on districts, or do you say, well, if you're based in a district that's property tax poor or personal income poor, we give you more on a per pupil basis. But at least we know then the distinctions between how much the state is doing. It's not the gap caused by, well, this local community can raise this much money to send to its schools, and the state kicks this much money in, and while here it's 70%, and then this district it's 50 because of the way the ratios work out.
I think it's important to note that in the view of most of the national observers, there's only one state that has a worse school funding system than Pennsylvania, and that is Illinois. So I'm not sure we want to model ourselves after Illinois.
Okay, we're going to take one more question before we head into further panel discussion. Go ahead.
Good evening. My name is Cheryl Kleiman. I'm with the Education Law Center. And Dr. Lane, you've talked about a few of the factors that you're either currently getting additional funding for or the formulas identified. And I was actually hoping you could talk a little bit more about English language learners, mm-hmm. because not only do they have unique needs, but districts like Pittsburgh are not serving a predominantly, you know, for example, Spanish-speaking population. Instead, the students you're educating are from diverse refugee and immigration communities. And I know many of those students are also students with disabilities, so appreciate the challenges. And I was wondering if you could speak to that a little more.
That has been extremely challenging. Unlike most districts our size around the country, our English language learners are not Spanish-speaking. And our largest growing language group last year was Uzbek. And as I told the commission, finding people to translate and work with families and be able to talk to the kids is tough. It's tough. Because our distribution is across smaller numbers of many, many languages. I think we're at like 32 right now. And so that in and of itself makes it harder for our ELL program to serve kids' needs. It'd be different if all the kids spoke Spanish, and they don't. So that makes it harder. The other piece, as you said, is the issue of children who have some kind of special education need but are not English-speaking. Our special education people who make these diagnoses typically don't speak Uzbek. And so being able to get accurate identification of learning needs for kids that don't speak English when they're in very small and limited language groups for us to have translation services and those kinds of things are really important. We just spent some time talking just fairly recently how we're going to make sure that IEP meetings and those kinds of things meet the needs of our parents. And that is an increasing challenge for us. However, when you go to one of our schools that has this extreme diversity of children and where they're from, and I was just at one last week, I can tell you it's a wonderful learning experience. I was at one of our schools, I was at Banksville last week, and it was fun to see how kids are being recognized. Kids had pictures up in the hall in their native dress and with names and talking about some of the things that they do together. The kindergartners, each child was teaching the kids how to count in my language. And so there's a richness to that, but as I said, it's also very challenging.
And I think that's also an opportunity to round out the school day with quality after-school programs for our special groups of kids, and they have proven to be very special. The consortium is doing that in several locations, and it's wonderful.
As we mentioned before, the state pays for about 36% of the cost of students' education. Pennsylvania's been criticized for being below the 50% mark. Jay Costa, wondering why the panel didn't take up the issues of funding levels and funding sources.
I just think that there were many other challenges that I think they wanted to focus on. I think the goal is to get to a 50% funding formula in Pennsylvania. How soon we get there remains to be seen. The governor and his proposal, if you combine the changes he proposed in property tax relief combined with the levels of funding he wanted to provide, I think would have helped us get there sooner than later. But at the end of the day, I think the goal was not to set a particular funding level of 50%, but work towards that with something that we could, that would be real, that we can make those investments in an appropriate way as we went forward.
Anybody else respond to that?
Well, I think, again, from my sideline perch, the majority leadership of the legislature, which to its credit supported the creation of the commission, but it also was of a mind and I think gave some direction to the commission and participated in the commission's work. They didn't want to create a situation where the legislature would be obligated to any particular level of funding, short-term or longer-term. So the discussion, as has been reported, was mostly about, and the conclusion was mostly about, how do you distribute the money, whether it's a dollar or $1 billion. Again, I'm being redundant, but it's really important we get closer to the $1 billion than the $1 level. Otherwise, the formula is meaningless.
We always said that if the formula had been funded at 50%, the old formula, we would be in a very different place today. And we did couldn't do that. How many years were we at 50%? About three?
Back not in the long. 70s, I guess.
About three, yeah. 3 years maybe or something. And we haven't been since. So it's very interesting now we have a new formula, and I think what we all need to do is hold people accountable to fund it at the level it's meant to be funded at.
According to the State Department of Education, on average, $13,000 is spent per student per year. I'd like to start with Linda Lane. PPS spends about $19,200 per student. What goes into that number, and would more money from the state help Pittsburgh students?
I'll answer your last question first. More money always helps. More money always helps, and it's correct. Our spend per child, actually, I just got newer numbers, and it's actually higher than 19. It's 21, around 21.7, I think. But we are 16th of the 500 districts in spend per child. However, the things that I think have to be understood is when that has been part of a structure of a school district over a course of quite a bit of time, what happens is it's not always easy to adjust that in a way that isn't extremely painful. Mm-hmm. And we've done some of that. There are, I'm sure, some people in this room that lived through the right-sizing, which was going on in 2006, that closed 22 schools in the school district, to try to adjust that spend per child, to get deal with larger schools actually are usually more efficiently operated than small ones, and so getting our schools a little bit larger can help. However, I told the commission, I said, obviously, I want every child in Pennsylvania to have an adequate education. I do. I want them to have a great education. I tell people I had a wonderful public school education. I figure every kid should have that. However, I am the superintendent of Pittsburgh, and so these are the kids I'm most responsible for. And I'm very supportive of districts around the state which are growing, getting more money. That only makes sense to me. But I just don't want my kids to pay the price.
Well, I think it's just important because folks like to throw around that $13,000 figure, and it looks good in terms of our national ranking. We are close to the top 10. $13,000 looks good, sounds good, but it masks the fact that that good-looking figure is largely due to the generosity of taxpayers, local taxpayers around the state, including here in Pittsburgh. The district is able to spend $21,000, not because of the generosity of the state, but because of the generosity of local taxpayers first and foremost. And that's the situation around the Commonwealth. It also masks the fact that that $13,000 is what it's called an average. Our low-spending districts are somewhere less than 10. We have some other districts out in the Philadelphia area that drive up that average because they're spending close to $30,000 per student per year. So, again, that's why we are told that Pennsylvania has probably the most unfair, ineffective system in the country because of this gap, which in many states would be unconstitutional on its face. But our court in Pennsylvania, so far anyway, has said that it's not their business, that it's up to the legislature to figure out what this system that the legislature is obligated, constitutionally obligated to establish, what it has to look like. But we have a very unfair system, tremendous disparity, unequalness, if you will, and $13,000, again, good-sounding average, but we're all over the place. And the irony or the sadness or the moral dilemma in the view of many is that it is in many places the kids who have the greatest needs who are in areas, in districts, where they might even be close to that $13,000 figure, but it's most inadequate. If you're dealing with a complicated school district with many international languages, with many kids with special needs, many kids who need support services of various types. So a complicated system that we have with 500 districts here in Pennsylvania.
Well, I feel like the 13,000 or the 21,000 is very opaque. We don't actually know. It changes from district to district. What exactly does that number mean? Where's the money going?
Well, if you look at our budget documents, you can see where it's going. But basically, it's the things you might expect, just like we talked about keeping the lights on. We have to keep the lights on, right? We have to clean schools. We have to provide security people. We have school police. Of course, in any school district, the biggest spend is people, because it's only people that can do the teaching and being the principal and fixing lunch and all those kinds of things for children. So most of it is going to go towards salary and benefits for the employees. But then, of course, just like you have at your house, you know, we've got supplies and materials, and kids would like to have books. I have parents that come basically to our public hearing regularly and ask for things like, you know, we'd love to have more art teachers in our schools. We'd love to have more music. We'd love to have kids have librarian in their school. We don't have those things right now. We have each school gets a little bit of each of those things. And so, you know, I'm in the position of sitting there listening to people describe what they really would love to see, which we'd love to be able to do. Because I totally support the idea that it's not just about reading and math. But on the other hand, you know, we have to, at the end of the day, the numbers have to add up. So as we've dealt with our budget, we've combed through these numbers over and over and over. We've closed schools to save money. We've reduced staff to save money. We made some adjustments in some of our programs to save money, cut central office over 200 people to save money because of the things that we'd love to get more of it shifted to a more values-based place where we're doing the things that really would be quite meaningful in our classrooms. One of the processes we're going through right now as we work on our budget is called academic return on investment. So that basically just means looking at how you're spending your money for a particular program and seeing if you're getting the return you should be getting given the cost and the difficulty of doing it. So we're hoping to make some adjustments there so it wouldn't necessarily mean you'd spend less, but it does mean you want to spend it better toward things that are going to actually make more of a difference for children.
I think one of the other things that's really difficult is to quit doing something that hasn't continued to work for you. And I think everybody finds that, the legislature, a school, a family. We really need to begin to look at what is producing according to those dollars that are being assigned. And when we need to make a change, we need to have the courage and do difficult things. And Dr. Lane has talked about doing difficult things in Pittsburgh. I think many school districts and the legislature are all facing those very tough decisions. And it isn't easy because we can't compartmentalize the raising of our children any more than we can serving our elderly or doing the right thing across all people who are members of this state. And sometimes those discussions are very difficult and become plagued with politics.
Eric, did you want to mention
Well, anything? I think, I mean, the Pittsburgh number, I mean, that has been brought up by consultants. It's been brought up by our organization. It was brought up by the commission about how much Pittsburgh spends, not compared to, like, the Mount Lebanons and the Upper St. Clairs, but compared to, like, other urban districts in the Commonwealth, Philadelphia, Allentown, Reading. And if we take away, because what the Pennsylvania Department of Education does, I mean, one of the things that they show when you look at the expenses is actual instruction cost. That means take away the debt, take away any of the other factors that do not deal with what happens in the classroom, right, the instructional cost. In Pittsburgh, I mean, again, in the, as Dr. Lane mentioned, near the top in the state, near the top in the county as well, in terms of what they spend per pupil on instruction.
If I might add that we should not assume that because it's a big number in Pittsburgh that it's overspending.
That's right.
When the costing out study was done, and it is several years old now, but the costing out study that was directed by the legislature, the methodology was prescribed by the legislature, it concluded that almost all of the school districts in Pennsylvania were underfunded. They didn't have enough resources. Now, the good news is they decided or they concluded that Pittsburgh had enough resources. That begs the question about how they're being spent. But they said Pittsburgh has enough resources. They didn't suggest a cut. They said they have enough. And I would not want to compare them to Reading, for instance, that was just cited, because Reading was concluded to be the worst district. The costing out study said that the Reading School District had $5,000 per student per year too little in terms of resources to give all of those kids in the Reading District a chance to accomplish the state's standards and proficiency expectations. So, again, Pittsburgh is pretty well off compared to most of the districts around the state, one might add. But that does not necessarily lead to the conclusion that they're overspending. It speaks to the issue that so many of our districts, most of our districts, don't have enough resources, particularly urban districts like Philadelphia and Reading and Allentown, all of which were determined by the costing out study to be dramatically underfunded.
The costing out study was several years ago, and our district has had pretty substantial revenue reductions since then. So we were in a good, better space then than we are now after losing the charter school reimbursement and no additional money in the basic educational funding formula. We had some after-school programs we ended up reducing because of budget reductions. So that was then, this is now. And the fact of the matter is we're not in the place necessarily we were in when that study was done.
We're discussing how to make funding for public education more equitable so that all children have a chance at a quality education. Our panelists for this community forum are Jay Costa, Linda Lane, Ron Cowell, Eric Montardi, and Linda Kraushore. And once again, we're going to turn to the audience and see if anybody has any questions at this time.
Hi, my name is Maura Kaleida. I'm an incoming school board member for Pittsburgh Public Schools. Excuse me, sorry. I was wondering if you can talk about the impact of untraditional funding for our kids. For example, the Gates Grant that we had received in Pittsburgh. While it looks good from the outside, we often have to turn to district funds to continue the quote legacy that they have brought. What dangers do you see as far as allocating money towards consultants and things like that rather than versus arts or music, librarians, counselors, et cetera?
I'm going to back up a little bit talking about grants the district has gotten. We have been very fortunate in being able to write grants. We've had grants from local foundations, Fund for Excellence. We've had grants individually from Grable and Hines, and the list covers pretty much every foundation in the city. We've had national grants, federal, the Teacher Incentive Fund grant, which was substantial, we benefited from. And then, of course, the one that you're referencing is the grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. There's one thing I want to say in regard to those before I talk about how those monies had to be spent. But one thing that we have asked for, and I know our representatives in the legislature have tried to help us with this, when we calculate our cost per student to pay our charter schools, we have to count the grant money too. Now, when the Buell Foundation gives us a grant, a portion of that has to go to the charter school, but we can't pay it out of that Buell grant. We've got to pay it out of the district's operating budget, which is something we'd like considered as far as fairness in terms of the distribution of funds. So that's one thing. I do believe that one of the things that I know I've struggled with, and we've struggled with communication around our grants the whole time we've had them, because I don't know that everyone always understands. People do not give you a grant to do something that you just kind of make up after you get it. You have to write what you're going to do, and they'll say, yes, we'll help you pay for that, or no, we're not going to. And I'll use the Gates Foundation grant as an example of that, because I wasn't superintendent when we got that grant, but I was shortly thereafter. And we had to write what was a 68-page plan is about how that money was going to be spent. And I know many people, because we were having financial programs, so problems at the same time, so we were had money on one side and not money on the other. And people say, well, you've got plenty of money. What about that Gates money? I said, I can't pay teachers with it. I can't pay the light bill. I can't, you know, pay Pittsburgh Water and Sewer. That has to go for the grant. And most of that is going to be people that are not your employees because it's a grant. If you put on a group of employees, and we have put on some too, there are quite a few out of that grant, we all know at the end of the day there has to be a sustainability plan. So how are you going to continue that work without that additional income coming in? And that's one of the things we're working through right now. But I think our district has been very grateful to receive the grants, gotten to done some very interesting work with our teachers. That's been phenomenal. So that's been great. And so, as I said, it's not always the easiest thing, but it is important that we follow through with what we said we were going to do.
We have another question.
Hi, my name is Bridget Siri. I live in Verona, Pennsylvania, and I teach in Highland School District, which is in Allegheny County, in case you didn't know. It's in the top little corner. But I'm from Washington, D.C., which gives me what you would think is a unique perspective, but apparently I lived in a bubble inside a bubble in the Beltway. Recently, I got some notification because I'm very active with PSEA. It's been a wonderful tool for us teachers out here who are don't have time to read legislation in our off time because we don't really have much of it. But I've got some information about back-end referendum for tax increases in school districts, which terrifies me in many respects due to the fact that 5 years ago I was furloughed, which for someone who wants to be an educator as their career is completely devastating. So we're fighting right now, have been fighting for the last 5 years, for increases, for equitable funding for our districts, for the benefit of our students, which benefits teachers because our stress levels and our blood pressure might go down, and the influx of blood pressure medication in the state might go down also. I just wanted to hear from the panel as far as their thoughts on the referendum. I also lived in Sharon, Pennsylvania for about 7 years and saw the effects of referendum in Ohio, which also makes me alarmed regarding this topic. And at the end of the day, as an educator, I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I see the students in the classroom every day who I go to Target and I go to Walmart to provide them extra resources that my district cannot afford. And I know that's happening across the state. And there are many husband and wives who, when they do their tax returns, there's an argument on that Tuesday night before it has to be turned in that you're spending more than $250 per year. So again, that back-end referendum and how that all plays into equitable funding and the whole commission's work and everything like that.
Thanks. So, Jacobs, can you explain, though, what the back-end referendum is?
The back-end referendum refers to tax increases that a school district could impose each year. And if they go above an index number, then they're required to do a voter referendum. And there are also some exemptions. I think we had 11 or so exemptions at one point. It was reduced down to 3. So in order for a school district to raise revenue above the index, it has to be given to the voters first. And the timing of the whole thing, I never understood that because it doesn't work logistically. But in any event, I think it's important to know that that conversation, the back-end referendum conversation, is currently engaged as part of the conversations that we're having right now. As you've seen reported probably today, there's a level of commitment. I can tell you now that reading my emails, there's some dispute about the 750 that's being talked about, but that's another matter for basic ed. The proposal is that there'd be 350 this year and 200 next year, extra money in early learning and special eds, a little bit of $10 million in Head Start, and 2016-17, 250 and 50. Combined with property tax relief, question about doing a sales tax increase that would drive additional resources for property tax relief. The biggest issue we heard over the course of the past year with respect to folks receiving a level of property tax relief is folks don't trust school districts. They don't trust us, and they trust school districts less with respect to property taxes. So folks are saying to us, you know, how do you prevent the school districts from not increasing their taxes so that it erodes the property tax relief that we need, you know, because we're going to be increasing the sales tax over here, presumably get less property taxes. But if they keep raising the property taxes, I'm at a wash in a couple of years. So what protections can you put into place? Our colleagues on the other side of the aisle, Republican caucus, is pushing very hard to either eliminate or really reduce or limit the opportunities for school district to raise taxes. And so that debate is at the heart of our conversation as we speak. Other proposals have been put on the table, reducing the size of the index, cutting in half maybe. A proposal that came out today, I think Senator White from Indiana County put out a proposal that would, I believe, require 2/3 majority of a school board to increase the taxes in a school district. There are folks who want to eliminate all the exemptions that I mentioned earlier or eliminate the index, and any type of an increase of taxes has to go to the voters. We have to figure out a way to find a happy medium to make that work, because recognizing the challenges that school districts would have not having the opportunity to have increased revenue coming in to meet the needs of the students given the costs that go up. With respect to where we end up at, it remains to be seen. One of the ideas contemplated is, for example, not injecting or not imposing the back-end referendum requirement, the changes, until such time as Pennsylvania is funding at 50%. So that's something that's being considered, I think, as well. But there are a variety of issues along those lines. But, you know, the back-end referendum is an issue that I think that a lot of folks are concerned about. Any type of property tax relief that, you know, get a guard against the back-end increases by the school districts that erodes that property tax relief. And 5 years from now, we're back at the same place with our property taxes, but yet I'm paying 1.25% more in the sales tax, or, as the governor originally proposed, the PIT as well.
We're going to have Eric and then Ron.
I had to look at my data, but I would rest yourself a little bit, because I'm looking at Highlands, and they actually get almost twice the median from the state that the county gets. Like the typical district in the county from the state in 14-15 got about $2,300 in state basic education funding, and Highland gets around $4,100. So it's a little bit above there. Act One, is, as Senator Costa mentioned, combined a lot of referenda. There's front-end referenda. When we first got Act One in 2007, the first thing that went on every district's ballot for an up or down vote was to shift to either a higher earned income tax or to impose a personal income tax, which would have also taxed unearned income at the school district level, which currently does not exist in Pennsylvania. I think Philadelphia might under the Sterling Act, where they might take in unearned income. When they designed Act One, on the back end referendum, saying, okay, every year, every district's going to get an index. That's your cap. That's as high as you can go. If you want to raise taxes up to that index every year and you stay under it or at it, go right ahead. You can do it. There's no problem with that. As far as getting a Act 1 question on the ballot in front of the voters in Pennsylvania, since Act 1 has been in place, there's been about 7 referenda in this state, meaning that a district has said, we're going higher than our Act 1 index, We've gone to the Department of Education and asked them for either one of these 10 or 3 exceptions and maybe didn't get it fully funded, and now we have to go on the ballot and put it for an up or down vote. So we don't have a lot of experience with it here under Act 1 because the way it was designed, if you go back and read the documents when the governor proposed it, was this is the guard against extraordinary tax increases year over year. So you can have districts that say, well, our index is 2.3%. We can do a tax increase of 2% this year. Next year, the index is 1.5. We can do 1.3. And it's happened. I mean, it's happened in districts in Allegheny County. It's happened in districts across the state.
Ron?
Yeah, as I understood your question, the core of it was, what do you think about back-end referendum and what are the implications for the ability of a school district to raise money locally? I think it's important, again, to point out that the ability of school districts to raise money locally, as was suggested by the senator, is already limited, and it has been limited for several years now. And the legislature did provide some wiggle room, if you will, recognizing, one, just expenses go up year after year, and so that was the idea of the index. And to eliminate that wiggle room would be to ignore the fact that currently and for the foreseeable future, well over half of the dollars that will support K-12 education are going to come from local resources. To eliminate the remaining exceptions, and the two big ones that come to mind are about special education and pension. Both of those are directly tied to what the legislature appropriates or what they legislate. On the special ed issue, which has been one of the drivers in terms of increased costs for school districts and the need for them to exercise the exception, over the last 7 years, school district expenses across the state for special education have grown by about $500 million. The state appropriation for special education support to school districts has grown by $20 million. $20 million versus $500 million. That's why school districts have had to use an exception. And the same thing with the pension system that in some ways is out of control in terms of the spike right now, but that was state legislation that created that situation, not anything that school districts did. So it would really be, I think, highly irresponsible, and that's my judgment, my term, for the legislature to eliminate that exception or those exceptions that do allow school districts the flexibility to act in the interest of students. I think the legislature needs to ask the question as they consider eliminating the index or eliminating the major exceptions for pension costs and special ed, would that be in the interest of students? And the best way for the legislature to keep school districts from having to exercise those options would be to better fund special education and to get the pension costs under control. Both of those things are under the jurisdiction, if you will, of the General Assembly, not local school districts.
I want to get one more question in the second row. I believe you've been waiting for a minute.
I'm Evelyn Murr, and I'm a retired school psychologist. And I'm directly related to your just recent statement. I'm concerned about special ed, homeless, and how the funding for those children in parochial charters and the homeless. As a psychologist, occasionally we would be threatened with capping the number of children in a school district who could be identified and served. Could you just speak to that in terms of what the state is contributing, the $20 million versus a $500 million?
Well, the $20 million, I think, represents what has taken place in the past. The governor proposed, I believe, $100 million increase in special education funding. That has fallen on deaf ears up to this point. My expectation is that in this upcoming budget agreement that should be concluded soon, I hope, he'll be putting $50 million in this year and purportedly $50 million next year. It doesn't go anywhere near to reaching the $500 million increase that Representative Kyle talked about, but I think, and we did put together a special education funding commission to take in various factors and sort of tiering the allocations that the state provides. So we've got a long way to go, but you know, it's a question of limited resources that we were dealing with over the course of the past couple of years. And as we go forward, how we fix spending levels with respect to education and work through each of those areas. It's going to take us a while to have the appropriate level of special education funding along those lines, but we're working towards that end.
We have to take one more question from the audience, and then back to the panel.
Hello, my name's Ron Sofo. I am a former superintendent in the state of Pennsylvania and currently a CEO and operator of a very outstanding public charter high school in the city of Pittsburgh. I think, question, so three parts. It is the state's responsibility to run a thorough and efficient system of education, correct? School boards were created by the state. Although we're here talking about funding, and we've come to a point where we expect all students to high levels, but the governance, funding, and policy making in the state of Pennsylvania is not consistent with that mission or vision. And it's really, I believe, time for the legislature and the state and the people and the citizens to say we need a different form of governance. We're talking about a different form of funding and policy making if we really believe that we want all kids to high levels. The governance system is broken. You say school buildings and school districts are broken. This way of funding public education for the new mission of the 21st century is inefficient, incongruent with the mission. But nobody wants to talk about that. You put Band-Aids on the problem, and then you say bad school board. School boards, as they're constructed, and we have gotten to, they carry most of the weight to pay for public ed when it's a state responsibility. Who's courageous enough to take that on and fix it? It's like saying, school bus, go to the moon. A school bus was never designed to go to the moon. It's a form of transportation. You now want public school districts to take every child to a place that we never wanted before, with a governance system that was designed, what, at the turn of the 19th century? When are we going to own up to what really needs to be done if we want to raise the probability of all kids to high levels?
So what was the question there?
Are we willing to change the governance model and put more of the responsibility for funding public
ed straight on the state, as opposed to putting it on school boards, who then the state says, you're doing the wrong thing? They are a product of the state, and when it gets tough, school boards take the heat. If the state was doing what it was designed to do per the Constitution, let's own it at the state level, not at the local level.
Yes, Eric?
Simple solution, right? Shift the taxes, raise the sales and the personal income tax, have the state fund 100% of public education, the school boards receive the money on some type of formula, per pupil, differential per district, whatever. If the districts that want to raise a lot of money locally don't like it, then basically let them form their own school districts that are community school districts. They're basically private schools, right? Because then we'll know for certain if Pennsylvania says our goal in terms of funding public education is we give the same amount per pupil per district, or if they say, no, this district, let's assume, again, we're keeping districts here, right, 500 of them, we're going to keep those in place, that if they say this one is property tax and personal income poor, they get more from the state. This one gets less because it doesn't have the same needs. Then we know, okay, this is why District A gets this much more per pupil than District B. It's because the state has said that's because that's our end goal of what we consider to be fair and equitable in terms of funding. And then you have the districts that say, well, we like raising, like the ones you mentioned out in Montgomery County in southeastern Pennsylvania that want to raise $20,000 per pupil locally. They say, we don't like that. We don't want to have our ability to raise taxes locally and spend money locally because, let's face it, some of them, it does not take a $5 million increase to do it. It may take a $500,000 to generate a lot of money locally. If they say they don't want to do it, fine. Then you let them break off. They're not a school district anymore that you can compare to and say, well, it's not fair that this one spends this much on their kids and this district doesn't get as much. They're basically then, if you buy into that community, that's the school district or the community school system that you go to.
Linda, Lane, you look like you might have a thought.
Yeah, just a couple things. One, I did want to correct a number I gave you earlier. The number I said of central office staff that we reduced was actually 157, so I want to make sure to get that right. I spent recent weeks, days, working with the Wilkinsburg School Board, the Wilkinsburg kids, and their teachers. And even though, as I said, Pittsburgh is, you know, is my job, the kids in Pittsburgh are my job, but now, because of the decision of our two boards, the children in Wilkinsburg are our jobs as well. And as I got to talk to the students, it was so difficult for me to hear the things they did not have. Because I know our kids in Pittsburgh, there are lots more things we'd love to have for them too. But when I heard about the kind of lack in the school where children were attending, it was heartbreaking. And I'm sitting here thinking we're in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, but we have children in a school district whose needs aren't even being close to met in their school. And the only ones that seemed to really be upset about that were Wilkinsburg. Where were the rest of us? You know, that's my question. And so as we sit as adults and talk about formulas and Act One and all of those kinds of things, I think let's not forget we have children in this Commonwealth who are not being well served in their school districts. And at the end of the day, that is the issue.
So I'm going to get to you in just a moment. That kind of leads me into a quote here. In an interview with WESA, Duquesne School of Education Dean Olga Welsh says, "Educating all of our children is a social justice imperative that the entire community shares. If the commission's recommendations are enacted, would the new formula move the needle when it comes to this social justice argument?" I'll start with you, Ron.
Well, on that particular question, it helps. But again, it depends on the degree to which you actually fund the formula or use the formula to distribute dollars in a way that you begin to recognize this this issue of social justice or adequacy or equity or however you want to characterize it. At the end of the line or end of the day, bottom line, it's a question of making sure that the resources are available to support education opportunity for every kid, regardless of what their particular needs are, whether they're complicated or pretty straightforward, regardless of the zip code or the relative wealth of the district where they live. Now, Ron Sofo, Dr. Sofo, raised a question about governance. But, Ron, as you explained it, I think it still is mostly an issue of funding. And you can change the governance, if you will, and that doesn't cure the funding issue. I think that if we have an appropriately funded system, this balance that we have, balance of governance, balance of responsibility to make decisions, has worked fairly well in Pennsylvania. It's a little bit more challenging now than ever before because, personal opinion, we have too many school districts in this state, too many districts in Allegheny County. We have pockets of poverty sitting beside pockets of wealth, and that contributes to this problem of inequity or social injustice or however you, whatever words you want to use to characterize it. Ultimately, it is this matter of how is the state going to fulfill its obligation, constitutional obligation, to establish and support a system of schools. And unfortunately, our Supreme Court historically has said, again, as I mentioned earlier, not our responsibility, it's up to the legislature. Now, we just elected three new Supreme Court justices within the last couple of weeks. They can change dramatically the face of, and more importantly, the ideology, if you will, or the views of the Supreme Court, so that maybe, the litigation that is already in the works, because most of the folks in this room know that there's a group that have filed suit again. It's making its way through the courts. Ultimately, it will go to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And the question is the legislature or state government, does it have a responsibility to deal with this question of ultimately adequacy, not just equity, but adequacy? And is that something that has to do with a fundamental right of kids? Not a convenience, not something that's to the whim of the legislature or the goodwill of the legislature. Does it have something to do with a fundamental right that kids have to a quality education in this state that in turn creates an obligation for state government? Changing the governance structure, I don't think, gets to that issue. appropriate funding, maybe driven by a Supreme Court decision, would get to that core issue.
Linda Crusher?
I think there's something, though, that does get to that issue, and that is the capacity of community. We often think of our schools as existing as an isolated problem or an isolated institution. And building the capacity of community is really what gets at good governance. When people understand what their goals really are, who they're serving, what they're doing. And I think we get lost along the way sometimes, and we have. The consortium worked extremely closely with Duquesne when their high school was closed. And Duquesne was as sad about seeing their high school lost in their community as Wilkinsburg is in its community. But what was so interesting is, while the parents and grandparents wanted those high schools to stay open, the kids knew that they were not getting what they would need to become productive, earning adults. They knew that. And it was so hard for them to stand up against their own parents, their own families, their mayors, their communities. But they knew that what would be happening to them would be better. And we went to all of the hearings in Duquesne and watched Secretary of Education Jerry Zahorchak suffer as he got pelted with questions. It was so difficult, and I'm sure the legislature suffered just as much. It was incredibly difficult. But again, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but I think we have to really think about what not only are our schools doing for our kids, but what their role is in our economy and in our community, and think of them in a very different way if we want to stay, as you said, the leading nation in this world. We are not going to do it by the way we fragment our problems and don't think about them on behalf of the larger goals.
You know, on that issue, Linda raised the West Mifflin situation, and we worked very closely with her and a few others. And I can report to you that I think it's been a success. I've been in a school countless times in West Mifflin where I had the experience the kids from Duquesne being integrated into that school, and it's been a success. Mm-hmm. And my hope is, working now with Dr. Lane and the school boards from Wilkinsburg and the city, our expectations are that we'll replicate what I think took place in West Mifflin, because in my view it's been something that's been very beneficial for those students. And she's being kind when she talked about the families of the communities in terms of their desire not to have the merger take place. But we worked through all those issues, and Linda and others did a great job to making sure that happened for the kids. And I think the kids are benefiting from that.
Okay. Going to open it up to the audience one last time if anybody has any final questions for the panel. One in the middle.
Hi, my name's Matt Edgel, and I'm a citizen of the city of Pittsburgh. I'm also the Communications Government Relations Director from the Pennsylvania State Education Association. Several years ago, I lived in Michigan. I was born in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, but I lived in Michigan and taught there for over 20 years. And we enacted a formula that rolled back property taxes in the 90s and increased the sales tax from 4 cents on the dollar to 6 cents. Also, within that plan for the property rollback and the change in the way it was funded in Michigan, there was an element for schools of choice for students. And I'm wondering if that was discussed at all. I can also say that when that funding went into effect and it gave the state more of the funding responsibility and took away certain abilities for local districts to raise revenue, it made the local districts at points hostages to the state. For example, in 2011, when they rolled back funding in the state of Michigan, the districts simply didn't get money. There was no opportunity for a local district to replace the money with an increase in taxes. They simply didn't get it, and it drove many districts right out of business. It also caused an incredible diaspora from the city of Detroit. So with that said, is there an element of schools of choice within this funding plan, this funding formula?
The portion of the committees that I participated in, there was not discussion along those lines, to my knowledge.
One more question up front. Yeah.
This may have been covered. It's a, part of this is because I get so confused by these details. But I'm curious about what system is in place for funding to respond to a school district that has unique needs or needs that are somewhat unique. For example, in some school districts, we might have higher needs for security and things like that. Where does the additional funding come from, or does it just take a bite out of what's put out there?
Yeah. Sure, Linda Lane.
Yeah, I think that one of the challenges is all of us have unique needs that we believe should be considered. I mean, some of us, you know, we can all say we all agree on special education, we all agree on English language learners, but the very one you mentioned, higher need for security, because we've got some of our schools in a couple difficult neighborhoods in Pittsburgh, and parents, you know, want to know that kids are going to be safe at school. So always there are going to be things like that that I think all of us will see, but we have some special and unique features that should be considered. I think the weighting never will be perfect. You know, if students are weighted based on special education status or poverty or other things, it's never going to be perfect. So I don't think it's going to get granular enough where you're looking at every little thing that every district might want to consider. But I think there are some general things that we can agree on.
So I'm wrapping it up now. This is our last question, but it's actually a two-part question. So whatever amount we spend, what can be done in terms of equitable funding to ensure that regardless of the school district, all students have access to quality education? And part B to that is, what questions or what areas about this funding formula do you think people are missing? What's something, if you have it, that you want to highlight that you think just hasn't gotten enough attention? And I'm just going to go down the line and start with you, Jay Costa.
Well, I mean, I think it goes to the point that Ron has talked about. I mean, we can have the best funding formula in the world, but if we don't have adequate resources to support it, it doesn't help the effort in the end. And I also think things that are we're not maybe paying close enough attention to is the disparity issue, how poorly we are with respect to the disparity. We were making some advancements in the Rendell years when we were making those investments in education. Our kids were doing well. Our scores reflected that. We closed the disparity gap. But now I think we've gotten away from that, largely due to what took place in 2011, where that growth, that the disparity gap grew. So I think we have to take a look and focus more along those lines as well.
Well, first part of your question about ensuring access, it does have to do with resources. Money alone doesn't solve the problem, but you can't solve the problem without sufficient money. So the state has an obligation to provide its fair share to help level the playing field so that the zip code or the wealth of the district is not the determinant of whether a kid has access to a quality education. But local school boards are very important in this state. And the role of citizens, and I'm looking to this audience here, is very important in this state because you can have a lot of money and not spend it appropriately, not spend it wisely, not spend it in a way that you do enhance student access to the quality program. So two parts to that. First question, state share needs to be appropriate, adequate, and then smart decision-making at the local level. And what's missing? I've said it three or four times. What is missing is the certainty that there will be sufficient state appropriations to make that formula meaningful.
Okay. And with all that money, which I totally agree is necessary, I would just add that it is not about testing every kid to death to look at his academic performance. Academic performance, basic skills are critical, but so are the skills required in this current day and age of communication, of problem solving, of creativity that need to be part of how kids learn basic skills. And lastly, every kid that we graduate that doesn't believe that the future has a place for him or her is a person that is going to be needing other money from our legislature in many, many ways, whether it is to keep them in jail, to keep them in some kind of support. So we need to recognize that if we evaluate totally the wrong way this good spending of more money, we are not going to get what we want. And I would just suggest, I think it's the last second I have to say something, but I was looking at the frequently asked questions around the budget impasse, and it said, is this any risk to the public? And the answer was a resounding no. I think it has been a risk. I think we have placed high stakes on holding back and waiting until we have a budget that makes sense for Pennsylvania. And I hope that we didn't lose too much and that we will gain much more by what we've done.
Linda Lane?
I agree with Senator Costa in that a formula is important. It is. But unless there's cash behind it, you know, it's just philosophical, basically. So that's going to be extremely important, that there is money to actually make it work, because I think we've all heard there's a formula before, but the money wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And to get back to that place is not a success. To the question on the quality education and access, one of the things I mentioned before I just want to reiterate, and that was the addressing needs of the whole child, whether that is some of the issues some of you raised, homelessness, neighborhoods that are difficult. Some of our children are raising their younger brothers and sisters. Why can't you get to school? You're late. And we ask them, and they say, well, I have to get my brother on the bus before I can come to school. And so, you know, we should be glad they're there. So those kinds of things are things we're going to have to address above and beyond the academic piece. The academic piece is very, very important. We understand that. We also know that that's not the whole thing. That is not the whole thing. And for many of our children, until we can address some of those things that are around them, it makes it very hard for them to engage in their academic learning. So we have to be able to provide the foundational support they're going to need so that when they go into that classroom, they can attend to what the teacher is saying. They can take their things home so they're going to do their homework if they have it. And those are the things that I think are going to be very important, especially for a district like ours.
And Eric McCarty?
I'm sorry, I apologize. The first part of your question was, is there something about the formula or the commission? I'm sorry, I missed that.
I said whatever amount we spend, what can be done in terms of equitable funding to ensure that regardless of the school district, all students have access to a quality education.
And then the other part about the commission was?
Is there anything that you feel needs to be highlighted or commented on that people might not think of?
I would stress the earlier part about, you know, going and looking and see what the commission did, look at their recommendations from the final report. We're probably going to see what happens, because if they're supposed to reconvene every 5 years to look at the formula and determine is it a good formula or not, then, you know, if there's going to be some changes to it. I think that looking at the resources that the state puts out, that the local governments put out, or the school districts, and then, you know, the basic commission's charge was to say, how do we just drive out the money that the state raises? I mean, that was their charge. It wasn't really anything else. So I think all that other, where that, you know, builds in terms of access and, you know, equitable funding and everything, that's just a larger part that probably goes beyond the funding commission itself.
That concludes this 90.5 WESA Life of Learning Community Forum. Special thanks to our panelists, State Senator Jay Costa, Ron Cowell, President of the Education Policy and Leadership Center, Linda Kraushore, Executive Director, Consortium for Public Education, Linda Lane, Superintendent, Pittsburgh Public Schools, and Eric Montardi, Senior Policy Analyst, Allegheny Institute of Public Policy. The assistant producer for this forum, Sarah Schneider. Production assistants, Maura McLaughlin and Sean Ray. Marketing, Elizabeth Baisley. Director of Engineering, Russ Lloyd. Executive producer for special news projects, Kevin Gavin. Thanks to our audience here at the Community Broadcast Center, I'm Larkin Page Jacobs. This has been a special news presentation from 90.5 WESA. Thank you.